This podcast is brought to you by Benjamin, a workflow automation engine that allows advisors to focus on their clients rather than data management. Learn more at getbenjamin.com.
Today on Bridging the Gap, I have the honor of speaking with Charles Chafin. Charles is an author, consultant, and educator with an extensive background in financial psychology, one of my favorite topics. We jumped into this episode with Charles opening up about his passion for research and his process of researching and answering the industry's burning topics. Charles and I dig into the ability of our brains being able to shuffle through the overload. Does that resonate with anybody out there with everything going on? And what our clients may be feeling. We also talk about understanding our relevance as advisors within our clients' lives. And we talk about loneliness and where Charles sees technology is driving this epidemic of loneliness, which needs to be talked about. I found that to be super intriguing. This was an awesome conversation. Charles is just a fun person to talk with, and you'll find so much insight and have fun with this conversation. So thanks to Charles for joining me. Let's turn it over to the man himself, Charles Chafin.
This is Bridging the Gap with your host, Matt Reiner.
Charles Chafin, welcome to Bridging the Gap. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. How are you doing, man? How's everything on your end?
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm doing well. No, not a complaint yet. Not a complaint yet, anyway.
Yeah, well, let's see how this podcast goes, and then you may have a complaint of why did I spend so much time with this guy on the podcast, right? That could be something.
Well, I'd be passive aggressive about it. I'd tweet about it later if it were bad, you know. Oh, my gosh.
Matt, that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed our time. Man, this Matt guy, I can't stand him.
Oh,
yeah, that's fair. This is going to be a fun conversation. I'm excited about this. I mean, your knowledge on psychology and behavioral finance and the books that you've written, I'm really excited to talk about one that you're working with one of my good friends who's been on the podcast as well, Dr. Brad Klontz, and the psychology of financial planning, and also to get into NUM. I'm excited to talk about that book because I think there's a lot of aspects of it that are intriguing to just us as humans. But I'm interested, I always ask people this, the 13-year-old Charles Chafin, was he like, you know what, I can't wait to get into financial psychology and helping understand behaviors and go through that. I'm always interested in the journey that got you to where you are. But before we get there, what did the 13-year-old Charles Chafin want to do with his life? Or was this always on your radar of what you wanted to do?
I mean, I think it's, you know, I think there's an element with probably a lot of people, you know, there's an element of intellectual curiosity that I had. It's a curiosity about issues that people are facing. You wonder about things, and that sense of wonderment leads you on a lot of different paths. And more often than not, it takes you down a path you don't know where you're going to go. In my academic journey, I didn't do very much work in the financial planning space at all. But as you know, as you see the issues that have come about, I mean, I would both say relative to the stuff that from NUM, and you know, there's a Distracted Work World book that's going to come out next year that focuses on the cognitive side of social media and cable news and workplace productivity. And then on the other side, the work with Brad on the psychology of financial planning. It's been this curiosity of what are the hottest issues. And there, you know, it's both a curiosity as well as probably some element of self-efficacy saying, okay, you know what, I think I have the tools to help people do this. And so, you know, I think it always stems from curiosity. And, you know, I even as a graduate student, I, you know, always had a list that I always recommend anybody who's looking to study, have your 20 list of wonderments. What are your things? What are the things that you're wondering about? And for practitioners, you know, and some of the work that I did before this, when they wanted to participate in research or a firm that wants to participate in research, you know, I always encourage them to do the same thing. What are you thinking about relative to your practice? What are you curious about? What do you want to know more about? And just keep that list fresh, and it could take you down some really interesting paths.
You know, this is going down a kind of an interesting path in and of itself, because I'm always curious. I have this kind of, one of my values is learning. I have this passion to always learn new things. And I think it stems from curiosity, right? I always am trying to find new and innovative answers, but I have to understand things to find that. You're given your profession of being a researcher and always having this sense of curiosity. I mean, to someone out there that's like, I want to go research some things. I have all these things that I want answered, these questions answered. How do you go about researching, right? When you have this curious question of something, of how it goes, What is your process of going about finding, you may not ever find the exact answer, but finding different streets to go down based off of your curiosity just to build it? Like, when does that end? I mean, it never really ends, I guess, but what is that process that you go through in terms of researching and finding new ways of answering these questions?
Well, I mean, research in essence, it doesn't end. Research in essence is a conversation. So you see, you know, a certain topic and someone will write about that and conduct a study on that. And you'll read that study, you know, and say, okay, this is what this individual found. And you might say, well, you know, specifically in that study, you might have issue with the people that were part of that study. You might have issue with the timeline. You might have issue with variables that there are things that they didn't take into consideration. You say, you know what? I want to replicate that. I don't think that was exactly right. And so you do a study that is similar to that. And research is, in essence, then a conversation. And some other scholars are going to read that. They're going to see through transparency what you did. And then they say, okay, then they're going to poke holes in it, or the variables change, or whatever it might be. So, you know, it's no different than going to a cocktail party and trying to interject yourself into a conversation. You first need to know what the hell people are talking about, right? What are people saying? What's on their mind? And that comes through reading the journals. It comes through, in my work, talking to the firms, talking to other scholars, and finding out, okay, what's on people's mind? That's where the psychology of financial planning work came about. It's the hottest topic, right? And so you've got to better understand, okay, what are people thinking about? What are firms concerned about relative to this? Where do they want to be in 2030? It's always this benchmark of where do we want to be, and what is the value of a planner? So it really is about interjecting yourself into that conversation, knowing first what it is. And then ultimately, for somebody, and I know there are lots of advisors that are interested in sometimes getting involved in research, what you first want to do is figure out what tools you have at your disposal to answer those questions. So whether it's experimental, whether it's some sort of data analysis or more historical studies, I'd love to see more historical studies come out of financial planning, because we repeat things and we run in cycles with things. Human behavior runs in cycles. The market runs in cycles. And so we're not doing a good enough job of saying, okay, well, let's look at what happened, you know, in this case, 12 years ago or 14 years ago with the market downturn. And what did people do then? And there's some research out there. I'm not suggesting there isn't, but there could be more. So you build that toolbox, no different than the analogy that we use in psychology of financial planning. You build that toolbox, find the best route to answer those questions, and you go answer them at the risk of oversimplification.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great way of thinking about it. And I think back to, you know, some advisors are probably sitting here listening, like, you know, some people want to go dive into research. Some people like research, but I think that there's always this challenge with research leading to action. And I think that's like a challenge that's always there, right? You go out and you research a topic, you find something, but what's the strategy of helping to take that research and then actually getting it implemented, of acting on that information from that research? Or is that not necessarily the guide of it? I think that for advisors, it's a matter of saying, all right, well, Charles has done all this amazing research on human behavior, but now I have to figure out how to go act on it to start implementing that research. I think that's a challenge. And I'm curious to your stand, how do you go about that?
Well, I mean, you know, I always call it the so what. What's the so what of this research? You know, we're going to do a study together. We're going to work with a firm and do a study together. It's like, okay, what are we going to do with this? And in some cases, obviously, scholars are rewarded for publications and they want their papers to get published. But if you're working with a firm, you know, whether it's a small or large firm, what's the so what of this? Why are we doing this? You know, we call it applied research, essentially. This is a question that's generated from practice. It's a question that's about practice, and it's a question that's going to impact practice. And so there isn't a lot of theoretical research in financial planning. In some cases, that's a bad thing. But if it's applied research, and specifically when you're talking with a practitioner, you want to find ways to say, okay, you know, what's our end goal here? Why are we asking this question? And a lot of cases, you know, it's important to note that people hear that term research, and they, especially practitioners, that they have a real issue with it. And understandably, that again, these are papers that sometimes sit on shelves. Research is about asking questions and getting those questions answered. That's what this is about. And as a practitioner-based profession, that's growing and evolving very, very quickly. Research is trying to keep up. And in some cases, research should be a half a step or two steps ahead. And in some cases, it's a little bit behind because we haven't gone and tested some of the things that have been done in practice for a long period of time to say, you know what, these are the best approaches, or we should nuance this or whatnot. So I always think about research as just asking questions, because that's basically what it is. And there's lots of ways for firms and practitioners to get involved with that.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. And we went down a little bit of a tangent, but it's so interesting because I think that more and more research needs to be continued to be evolved inside of this industry. And to your point, we have a ton of data that we could utilize to look at historical aspects of it as well. I want to transition though over, and this is going to be a loaded question. I'm just going to preface with that. Your book, Numb, How the Information Age Dulls Our Senses and How We Can Get Them Back. I want to just ask, how do we get them back then? Tell us all what this is all about and just give us the answer of how we get our senses back in this overload economy that we're in.
Well, I mean, Numb is designed for people to go through a process, a reflective process to say, you know, all of these platforms, everything from social media to cable news to pornography to email, are these things working for the individual? And it's a research-based approach. It's a consumer book, I should mention that. But it's designed for people to say, you know what, this is really working for me or this isn't. And, you know, so I talk a lot about things like confirmation bias, loneliness, compassion fatigue, you know, where we are exposed to the you know, images of the suffering of others so much that it actually impacts our finite ability to be compassionate towards others. So what Numb is a journey for individuals to go down to say, yeah, I'm exhibiting this. I'm on social media for however many hours a day. And you know what? I have fewer authentic experiences with individuals. I'm lonelier now. This isn't working for me. Or if people say, you know, me watching cable news for 3 hours or whatever is making my life better, then that's their decision. But it really is designed to help people better understand their relationship with the information age and whether it's working for them or not.
That's really interesting because I was also reading, I just read Deep Work by Cal Newport. And I was, you know, it talks about how kind of like getting deep into understanding topics, which is a little bit different than what we're talking about here. But I'm wondering if our own brains are able to distinguish whether we're getting benefit from something or not, right? I think the challenge is that a lot of people are just like, they're so consumed with social media and they think that they're getting benefit from it, but it may be surface level, may not be the true benefit because they don't really actually know or aligning what their true values are with what their actions are. And that may be a challenge that's there. But are people even able to decipher that given how much information is being thrown at them and how much overload they have on their brain to be able to decipher whether it's actually valuable to them or not?
Well, I mean, on an everyday level, you know, what these devices do is create this dopamine loop for us, right? You know, so, and they're designed that way. They're designed to provide a series of rewards so that the individual can continue that action. That goes back to the work of the psychologist B.F. Skinner in the early, mid part of the 1900s. And so, you know, I get a reward. It's called operant conditioning. I get a reward for doing something, I'm going to do it again. Slot machines are designed the same way. So individuals get into this habit of being in this dopamine loop or being in this reward structure that is absolutely challenging. However, what Numb and there are other books like it trying to do is say, okay, let's take a step back here and let's have a reflective process. Let's look a little bit more longitudinally. You know, no different than you would with a client when you're trying to address elements of spending and saving or even investing. Let's look at a pattern of behavior over the past 2 or 3 years. How's this going? How many push notifications are you looking at? How distracted are you? What's your circle of friends like? You know, and if you say, well, you know, if somebody says, and I've had people email me from them. I get a lot of emails from people who say, yeah, you know what? I have 2,000 Facebook friends, but I'm lonely. That's the number one thing I hear all the time is, you know what? I realized this. And by the way, I mean, that's one of the hardest things for somebody to admit. They say, I'm lonely. I have all these people I connect with. I'm scrolling all the time. I'm on Instagram. I'm trying to get likes and all those different things. But I realize I don't have authentic experiences with other people anymore. And some of that was related to the pandemic, but some of it wasn't. I mean, we have an epidemic of that. So No, it's very similar to the work of an advisor. I mean, these two books are coming out relatively at the same time. Brad and I's book and Numb that came out before is really trying to, in some cases, do the same thing. And that is evaluate behaviors at a macro level and say, what's working and what's not. And there's no judgment either way, just like there's no judgment on the part of the advisor. Now, the advisor may offer nudges. The advisor may offer automation. The advisor may do things like exquisite listening techniques and things like that to try to help get the client to take action that's consistent with their goals, right? It's still not a judgment thing. It's trying to, you know, you want this. Okay, let me help you with behaviors that are going to get you to that. But both of those things are really designed for the individual to say, yeah, okay, this is not working. Here's what we can do to maybe fix it.
Yeah. And going through that process, and I think that gets kind of to, which I want to talk about, like the impacts of cognitive overload with regards to personal finances, because I think that especially right now we're in this time when you've got inflation, you've got, you know, geopolitical issues, you've got political, just inter, you know, country political issues, and you've got a lot thrown at you. And we always talk about money as being one of the most highest concerning things, right? That's what stirs people the most is money. And I'm curious of what the impact is of cognitive overload and how advisors can really help their clients decipher or separate their feelings from what they should be doing and do it in a way that's not just like, hey, this is the data, this is what you need to do, because as we know that doesn't really help individuals. So I'm curious on what you've seen as being a value from the cognitive overload that advisors can help with on that side.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the risk of oversimplification, the advisor really just needs to listen more and walk that client through some of these emotional issues that come with market volatility or life changes or whatever those things might be that are going on with the client. I always find it fascinating that, and I talked about this in a podcast episode a few episodes ago on my own podcast, just talking about the idea that, you know, if I walk down the street here in New York and ask 100 people, so should you buy high or buy low, or should you sell high or sell low? What do you do when it comes to the market? The overwhelming majority of people are going to get that correct. People know at a theoretical level to buy low and sell high. They know that. Well, why don't they? So let's start with that. So we have a lot of, not a lot, but we'll say some members of the profession that feel like, I need to tell them that. No, you don't. They know that already. It's the instincts and the biases that we all have embedded with us that create this anxiety where we do these irrational things that go against our better judgment. Because that's what this is about. I use the analogy of, it's like that friend that you have who gives the best advice. I mean, they give great advice when it comes to relationships or whatever, but their own life is a disaster. I mean, you know, they got relationship problems, they got all this other stuff, but they still give the best advice. And the reason for that is because all of those are most likely the reason. I don't know everyone's friends, but likely the reason for that is because there's all those emotional elements. Some of them are instinctual and they're embedded within us. They've been part of our brains for, you know, 100,000 years. And some of them are related to, you know, financial flashpoints and our money beliefs. And some of them are related to clinical issues or whatever they might be that supersede that. So going back to your question relative to advisor, it's the old adage in education that I talk about with advisors, and that is telling is not teaching. It's just not. Telling a client these things is useless because, like I said, first of all, they likely already know that. But walking through that relative to this idea of listening, let's get to the heart of what the anxiety is. Let's talk about that and let's play this out. Let's play out what could happen here and what's happened historically is helpful, right? Here's what the market tends to do. We tend to see a gain 4 out of 5 years, yada, 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 all those different things. So if we, and Brad and I write about this a lot, and we have a lot in our certificate that we're offering, is here's what you need to do to walk through using things like exquisite listening and different communication and counseling strategies to really get to the heart of this, rather than just saying, hey, by the way, Edith, you need to make sure that you don't sell low. Yeah, Edith already knows that.
You mentioned this idea of Well, you mentioned a few things I want to touch on. You mentioned this idea of exquisite listening that I want to go back to, and I'd love for you to dive deeper into what that is and how you are an exquisite listener as opposed to just a regular listener, I guess, from that standpoint. But you also mentioned how about your friends who are telling you this advice, but they're terrible at doing it themselves. I think about that sometimes with financial advisors. They're really good at giving the financial advice, but they're probably sometimes the worst at managing their own money and their spending habits and knowing their budgets. And if you flip the tables, it would always be interesting. So it just is a perspective, right? If you think about it from our side as well. But exquisite listening, what is that? Tell us about it. I've heard it a few times.
Yeah, so basically, there's a number of strategies that we incorporated in the book relative to communication and counseling, but it's a way to essentially make sure that the client is heard, establish trust with the client, and make sure that you are getting to the heart of the issue, and in some cases that you are going through scenarios. And you know, Brad's written about this a lot before we got to the book, and added some of these things of is really good about this idea of scenario planning. Okay, well, let's do the worst case scenario. Let's dive into it. What does that look like? You're going to lose your job. I had this with a friend of mine last night who was saying he was worried about losing his job. I said, well, let's go down that path. You lost it. Now what? Well, I'd have to do this and this and this. Okay, what would that look like? And so let's go ahead and kind of uncover that, what exactly it looks like, and kind of address those fears. It's not an easy process, and it is that element of listening, which is, you know, 75% is the client talking, and 25% is the advisor being, I think, that facilitator more than anything. And, you know, I mean, and I would just say too, how many listeners do most people, good listeners, do most people have in their lives? How many people of, let's just say, of a client base in this country have people that are really asking them about what their goals are, what their hopes are, what their fears are? Not many, right? And so if we as a profession, regardless of what our business model is, if we can be that person to prompt, to be that person to nudge, to listen and respond, we're creating incredible value. Because in reality, you know, with all of this stuff, you know, this is capitalism. I mean, that's what we're talking about here with the psychology of financial planning. I mean, we've got, you know, you have planners on this that are listening to this podcast that they just want to change the lives of their clients. That's what they want to do. They want to have a positive impact. But at the end of the day, capitalism is about relevance. And if we want to be relevant as a profession, these are the things we've got to be doing. The travel agent industry went through this 30 years ago, right? You know, they were the ones that used to book all the tickets, from what I understand. And now you don't have to do that. So where's your relevance? Where's your relevance as a profession? Your relevance now is knowing the families that you're a travel agent for and saying, hey, I know you really like that Airbnb or that bed and breakfast rather that you had in New England. I know a great place for this year. I think it's great. I know the owners. Let's do that. Because you don't need to book the tickets anymore. And that's the same parallel that we have in planning. We've got to be better listeners. We've got to look at and address some of the challenges and goals of the clients. We've got to nudge. There's an element of coaching and behavior modification that's part of it, not from a judgment perspective, but behavior modification from, okay, we're going to do this. Now that's inconsistent with where you said you wanted to be in 10 years, right? Those different types of things.
It's so interesting that you bring that up. And I love the travel agency example because it reminds me of like, well, you know, our value, you know, the travel agent's value used to be planning, getting the tickets, right? That's not it anymore. Now the advisor's value used to be buying and selling the investments. That's not needed anymore, right? That's not needed anymore. Now you got to be relevant in another way. In simplification way, this idea of behavioral psychology and behavioral finance, we've inherently been doing it forever. Right? We've been inherently doing it. Now it's really just like exposing it and helping us be better at it, it seems like. I mean, is that fair to say? Because I mean, advisors have been having to deal with client issues. Maybe I guess it's the point is that we haven't done it well, or is it that we really haven't been doing it just because we were so focused just on investment management? Like, is this just a push, this idea of psychology of exposing what we've already done and shining a greater light on it? Or is it that we really weren't doing it and now we need to start doing it?
The answer to that is probably yes. I mean, there are advisors who in a lot of cases have great instincts to listen, and they know when to be quiet. They know when to prompt to do some of the things I've already talked about. Now, do they have a full toolbox of the things that, you know, Brad and I are writing about? Probably not. I think there are things in here that, could actually help. You know, we go through a whole process. We talk about cultural competence, and we're talking about this idea of client crisis. Here's six steps when a client calls you and has a crisis and they haven't yet told their spouse. Here's the six things you need to think about. We bring that from another discipline that's theoretically sound and actionable. So that's one piece. So there have been some that are doing it. There are some people who, you know, you hear from some advisors that say, well, you know what? It's a soft skill. It's not a soft skill. Soft skills are completely different. Or an advisor will say, you know what? I got that after working with clients for 15 or 20 years. And my first thought is, well, what the hell? What about the clients from year one to 14? How did that go? Right? I mean, well, what are these, you know, we all have trial and error. I'm not trying to minimize that comment. I mean, there's some truth to it. I mean, it's true. I mean, that's probably true that you learn different things and you learn by doing things the wrong way. The outcome's bad and you adjust and whatnot. I think the opportunity now is just so big for the profession to be in this space. It goes back to this idea of the value of the planner. And making sure that every planner within every firm, within every business model can go ahead and react, respond, understand their clients in a deeper way so that they could do some of the things that we talked about. And by the way, you know, I should mention, which is a huge focus of our work, is making sure that the advisor understands themselves. Because so that you're not imposing your worldview. And a lot of cases you do it subconsciously. So it's not as if advisors are trying to be heavy-handed. I want to make sure I'm not suggesting that. But you have a worldview where you impose that onto your client so that better understanding, okay, what was the advisor's experience with money growing up? And how could that impact the client planner relationship and whatnot? So I think it's an opportunity. I think that people are going back to where I think, again, where, you know, there's probably a little bit of a bias here on my part, too. But the work in NUM and the work that Brad and I are doing in the psychology of financial planning, we have a loneliness epidemic. We have people who feel overwhelmed for lots of different reasons right now. And what they need is a steady hand, a facilitator, a coach, a partner, and an advisor that can help listen to their concerns, better understand where their biases are, and help them stay with the plan, making sure that they're taking action and decisions and whatnot. It's an opportunity for the profession.
So, and I want to get to this. I do want to talk real quick, and it's a little bit off topic, but this you've mentioned a few times, and I agree with you, this epidemic of overwhelmingness and loneliness. And I want to talk about kind of what's spurring that in a second. But before I get there, I want to wrap this conversation up because you mentioned that there's an opportunity for advisors with this, right? With the, you know, the psychology of financial planning and the ability to add value to the client. I think that one thing that I've had conversations with others about, and I've kind of continued to be curious on, is how does an advisor show this value? I think that this is the challenge that advisors are facing right now in this kind of transition from being an investment manager to being a behavioral coach, so to say, right? Is as an investment manager, your value is seen in the performance. Behavioral coach, there's no quantitative analytical way necessarily, maybe there is, to show your value. So how should value be shared or shown to clients when you go down this approach of the behavioral side of things?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it too does depend upon the business model, right? I mean, there's certainly some of that that's there. I mean, performance is important. It absolutely is. But look at elements of market volatility where clients may be making knee-jerk reactions, right? And talking them through that or providing historical context and whatnot. That relationship is incredibly valuable. And the advisor shouldn't really be shy about going ahead and saying, you know, staying on this path, the path that we just talked about doing is going to save you this. It's going to yield this and whatnot. I mean, there are opportunities to do that. There's no question about that. And saying, if you did this, this is what would happen. We're going to do this. This is what I'm steering you towards. And this is the right approach. So there is elements of that. It's relevant for an advisor to be saying that, to say, yeah, this is the right path. And this is what it's yielded for you as a client.
Yeah, I think that that's the way of doing it. I've always loved those charts of showing like this is what the market did, this is what your portfolio would have done if you were kind of the jittery Joe, but you were the steady Sam, and this is what led to your value. And you know what? You'll never be able to pay me back in fees for the value that I just created for you just within that period of time, right? It's gonna be something as simple as that. I know you never present it that way, but I want to go back to this epidemic. Concept of loneliness and overwhelmingness, because I think that this is really important for us just to understand from a mental health standpoint of what's going on in the world today. Because I think for advisors, it's good for us to be aware, because you have to understand what your clients are coming into so that you can talk with them in ways that are helpful. But the loneliness and overwhelmingness epidemic, what I'm curious of, what is driving that, and is there an end in sight for that? Because I think that, you know, with technological innovation and the demands of jobs and just the demand of the world, I don't see it stopping anytime soon. I just see it getting maybe even worse. What was the driver of it, and what's the way to curb it over time?
Yeah, I mean, the loneliness piece is, you know, there are data out there that suggests that, you know, we have 40 or 50% of the country has some element of loneliness. And there are different types of loneliness that the individuals experience. I think when you look at the elements of social media, we'll talk about that for a second. Social media, it's a chicken or egg in some regards. You know, some people are drawn to social media because they're lonely. And there's lots of people that want to connect. I don't want to suggest that it's all about loneliness by any means, because that's not the case. But there are some people too that are spending 3, 4, 5 hours a day on social media, and the average is like 160 minutes per day, by the way. That has to come at the cost of something. If it's 160 minutes a day, what is that replacing? And in a lot of cases, what it's replacing is authenticity, that authentic interaction with individuals, that I'm seeing you face to face, even for 10 minutes. I'm not looking at my phone, even though, you know, we're on Zoom right now. I'm talking to you. You're talking to me. I'm not looking at my phone. I don't have a television on around me or anything like that. My attention right now is focused on you. And same thing we have with an advisor to client. I'm reading your facial expression. If you and I were having coffee and talking about something personal and I wasn't distracted and you weren't distracted, I would notice your facial expressions. I would notice your joy or your pain or whatever it is that you're experiencing, and I would respond to that. You can't get that in social media. It's harder to get that through these types of digital experiences. And in a lot of cases, you know, I'm not a clinical psychologist. I had a clinical psychologist tell me when I was working on NUM, say, it's like we have a thirsty population that's thirsting for authenticity, and they're going to social media, and all social media is salt water. And they're just drinking more and more of it. And so they're, you know, and I talk about in the book what people could do to kind of address that. I think when it comes to advisors, you know, one of the key questions really, especially when you get that kind of discovery stage and you're at that goal stage, is, okay, what does, you know, especially if you're talking about retirement, what does retirement look like? What does a Tuesday, you know, and all your advisors are probably doing this that are listening. I'm not telling them anything profound, but, you know, what's a Tuesday during your retirement look like, and who's part of that? And what are you part of? You know, and part of this element of loneliness is not being part of something bigger than yourself. And that could be something as simple as a church or synagogue or a mosque, or it could be as simple as joining a local gym and being aware of people around you and trying to make that connection. And so for an advisor, kind of let's paint that picture. What does that look like? That can be really helpful. And a lot of times we rush into trying to get that answer. That sometimes it's good to let that sit for a little bit and try to loop back and say, think about that for a second, or think about that for a week. Who's going to be part of this? Which is really, really important. And I'll mention one other thing. One of my favorite studies is, we researchers, you know, we have favorite songs, but we also have favorite studies, which is kind of insane. But there's some great work out there about this element of luck, and people who describe themselves as lucky and people who describe themselves as unlucky. And there was a really cool study done a few years ago that basically there was this fictional coffee house full of people. And the researcher found two participants to go into that coffee house. One of them described themselves as lucky, and one of them describes themselves as unlucky. And the researcher put, I think it was a $5 bill just lying on the steps of the coffee house randomly, and then had a one empty seat in that coffee house, and had somebody who was playing the role of a business person sitting next to that empty seat. So the first person went in who was described themselves as unlucky, didn't notice the $5 on the steps, completely oblivious to it, went and sit down. The author interviewed the person, said, so tell me about your day today. Oh, it was fine, but you know, this place is packed full of people. It's loud. I was sitting here waiting on you. That's about it. The person who described themselves as lucky walks in, sees the $5, picks it up, puts it in their pocket. I think it was in the UK. I think it was £5. But anyway, they go in, they sit down, they start chatting up this person who's the business person, and they start coming up with these ideas or whatever. So the researcher says to the person who describes himself as lucky, tell me about your day. And they're like, it's been great. I found $5 outside, or £5 outside. I was talking to this person. We might do some work together. He's got this and this and this or whatever. It's been a good day. The point of that is people who tend to find themselves as lucky, they are more open to opportunities, and they make the most of the situations they have. And the tie into this relative to loneliness is that they take their social capital and they use it to their benefit. So if they lose their job or if something bad happens, they have a capital and a network. And there's lots of research out there, by the way, about people who get into bankruptcy and their social circles. I think that's something that Lance Palmer at Georgia wrote about a couple years ago. So if we could create that cap, if we could take individuals within our environment and see that as opportunities to connect relative to loneliness and use that to our advantage, not using people, but really making the most of our situations, we're going to be better off.
I mean, it goes back to like your perspective. You can say I have to do something, or you can say I get to do something, right? The people that say they have to do something are probably not going to enjoy it as much as the people that say I get to do it. It's a perspective of a mentality that I think that social media, and I'm curious if you've seen any research on it. I'm sure I'm almost confident there is some out there about the thing about social media and why it's not a good use of your social capital is I can control what you see. There's very rarely on social media do I share that I've had a shitty day and that, you know, everything, this has been really difficult for me. I always share that my day was amazing. Look at where I am. And look at how great my family is, right? And everybody, like, you're always now, it's a comparison all the time. And we can't, even though we know that, right, mentally, we can't overcome that cognitively of its impact on us as people. And that's got to be driving of it as well. I mean, to a large extent, if I were to assume.
Well, you know, it's like bad poker playing where you know you're bluffing, but you don't think anybody else is, right? I mean, we've curated lives. People curate, and they put, to your point, they put their best foot forward. So but there's a lot of reasons why that it gets into FOMO. I'll get that in a second. But one of the reasons why that's a problem is we're connecting with people on social media who we don't know, and they're curating their lives. I mean, so, you know, there's a number called like Dunbar's number, you know, like 150 people who we could have connections with. And I actually mentioned, I mean, there's lots of benefits to social media. I mean, there are tons of benefits. It's great to connect with people we know. The problem is when we start connecting, like even on Facebook, with people we don't know, right? Then these curated lives, we start saying, oh my gosh, you know, look at that. Look at them. They're on vacation all the time. I've made all these terrible decisions. I'm not on vacation. That person's on vacation all the time. You know, if I don't know that person, if I know that person, if it's like my, you know, Uncle Bill and he's curating his life, I'm like, yeah, I see what he's posted. Uncle Bill's a mess. I know Uncle Bill and I know he's a mess. So it doesn't bother me, right? But what happens is we get in this element of FOMO, and FOMO has lots of impact, as we know, on investing and crypto and things like that. But we start, the worst part about it is we start questioning our own life choices. When you go from a point, and I use this analogy in the book, you know, you're at home on Friday night with your significant other and you're eating ice cream, watching a movie, and you're happy as a clam. And then you take a break from the movie and you go on to social media and you see all these curated, you know, people are, you know, it's like a beer commercial, right? First of all, everybody's in great shape and having a great time, which we all know is not realistic. Beer drinkers don't all look like that. And then we go, well, what the hell am I doing eating this Haagen-Dazs ice cream? But now suddenly you went from a place where you were happy, right, to thinking with social media and FOMO, you're like, my life is a mess. And who is this person I'm with? I mean, you know, what am I doing here? So it kind of, you know, FOMO is certainly a big part of that. But yeah, we curate, we try to put our best foot forward, and we spend a lot of time on that. And there are lots of challenges with that. I just did an episode on the issues of adolescence and social media and eating disorders and things like that that come from this desire for attention and desire to put our best foot forward. But yeah, it's an ongoing challenge. And the way to address some of that stuff is you have to manage it. It's designed to manage you. It's designed to steal your attention. It's designed to, you are the product. You are the product that these platforms are giving to marketers, to advertising agencies. And if you realize, if you take a step back and say, you know what, I've been doing this 3 hours a day thing on social media for 5 years, and you know what, it's not working. I'm not as happy as I was. I'm not as connected to my spouse or partner. I used to do X, Y, and Z, and now I don't. In some cases, people create, they start to see themselves as content creators. They actually look at vacations and say, okay, what's going to be the most compelling on Instagram? And the things that they want to do, they might say, well, that's not going to be compelling, so I'm not going to do it. So if we could take a step back and say, at a 30,000 foot level, is this working for me or is it not? And kind of walk through the things that I have in the book or whatnot, that could be helpful, a helpful exercise.
Yeah. When you said that idea about vacations and social media, I can think of just this conversation I had with a client that their daughter wanted to go to this one place and they had to be there at sunrise because they needed to take a picture because it would go into the Instagram story. And it wasn't, they didn't even care what this place was. They just knew that it was this like social media haven for the content to be perceived by the others. And I do love that idea that social media is trying to manage us, and we've got to manage it. And I think that that's something that needs to be repeated time and time again for future generations, because I do worry about what it can mean. And I know you've done some research on that as well. But I want to wrap this up because I know you've got housekeeping in the hotel that needs to come into the room and kick you out. And so I want to be cognizant of that. But I want, before I ask you my two final questions, I do want to close with this question. Given your work that you've done with Dr. Klontz, Dr. Brad Klontz, in the psychology of financial planning, I'm curious to your perspective. What is the future of this industry? You look at it 5 to 10 years from now. You know, I look back 10 years ago and where we were. You know, the idea of financial planning was like, yeah, you know, kind of, don't really do it. I do a cash analysis and that's about it. Now it's like ingrained. What is it 10 years from now? And what does the difference look like in the future than it is today in your mind?
I think it's a rosy picture for advisors that are really, and advisors and firms that are serious, and there are lots of them that are, about this element of having a deeper understanding of their clients. I think it's a very rosy picture. I think they're going to get their clients to take action and adopt their plan. I think they're going to have clients that don't necessarily come from the same backgrounds or look like them. I think they're going to have a higher wallet share. I think they're going to have all those things. And I think the value and impact they're going to have is going to be so much higher because of all the things that we're talking about right now. One of the things that we talk about that we don't hear a lot about is we've got to help clients manage this information age. We've got to help them, no different than we see this with physicians right now, that patients are going online and getting information, and it's not necessarily helping because the physician is saying X and they're going on online and finding information that's actually contrary to that. And we all know how that can be. So, you know, advisors are going to have to continually be steering their clients to, okay, here's good sources if you want to learn more, because we have ones that want to do that. So I think it's a rosy picture. And the transactional side, I think most firms and advisors know that that's gone. There's still going to be some of that. But I think the people entering this profession, the men and women that are coming into this profession, want to create this impact, and they're going to do it in a systematic way by better understanding all of these biases, being better listeners. I think an approach where you see more, you know, we have a team approach that comes with financial planning already, where you have estate planning lawyers and accountants that are involved, and the financial planner is that quarterback that may not be able to fix those problems, but can identify them and can refer them. I think we're going to see more of that team approach when it comes to some of these other elements. You could see there are challenges there, but you could see clinical psychologists being involved in some of this. You could see social workers being involved, and you could see this, again, you could see the skills of the financial planner being that human element first, not discounting knowing estate planning, investments, tax, and retirement and everything else, but that human side is going to be important. But I think that team approach could expand, particularly within larger firms down the road.
Gosh, I love that picture. That is a rosy picture. I think that that's so powerful, and not only for the financial advisor industry. I mean, what a benefit to the client, right? What an advancement of value that they would receive from this service offering. I think that there's a win-win in my mind there.
I would just interject, you know, one of the things we've got, Brad and I have these two books and this instructional program and all this stuff. One of the things that's been driving us in doing this and working on this all this time has been how many families are going to be impacted by this positively with a workforce, a willing workforce. I mean, I have, you know, I came into this profession from academia and it's been 12 years now, and it's hard to find a financial planner that doesn't want to help people. And, you know, even with this stuff coming out, people want it. They want to help. So to me, I look at it, I guess probably selfishly, but it's exciting personally when you say there's an opportunity to impact potentially millions of clients and families, and you've got a credible opportunity and a credible need, and you've got a workforce that really wants to do it. What more do you need, right? I mean, that's all right there. So it is a rosy picture, and I think we're going to get there. And I will say, I guess, on the potentially the negative side, there's no other alternative. What's the alternative is irrelevance.
Yeah.
That's the alternative.
Yeah. I love it. I'm there with you, and I hope to be there waving the flag with you and Dr. Brad Klontz and continue to push that, because the impact is amazing and it's huge from that standpoint. So, Charles, you've been so gracious with your time, and I'm grateful for that. You know, two questions I need to ask you that I ask all my podcast guests before they leave, because these conversations are mainly driving all of our ability to learn from great minds like yourself. And another way to learn is by reading. So I always like to ask people that we talk to what books they think we should be reading to continue to learn outside of your great books of Psychology of Financial Planning and NUM. But what's one or two of those books that you think everybody should go out and read?
Yeah, you know, like I say, recommending your own book is like giving your book out as a Christmas present. You know, look at all the disappointed faces on your family. Hey, here's a copy of my book, everyone. Happy, you know, Merry Christmas or whatever. I recommend The Paradox of Choice by Barry Schwartz is a great book. Getting into this element of choice overload, we think that choice is a great thing. We tend to be, in some cases, incapacitated by it. Has lots of relevance to clients, how we could deal with choice architecture, things like that. Good Habits, Bad Habits by Wendy Wood gets into this element of how we can, and we incorporate a lot of that into Psychology of Financial Planning, how we can change our environment to that essentially people that have good habits are not necessarily better people than people that have bad habits. They just have an environment that's more conducive to good habits. An oldie but a goodie is Punished by Rewards by Alfie Kohn, K-O-H-N. Punished, that book's been out for quite some time. Gets into this element of intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. It's designed for teachers, but I love that book when it comes to how we can motivate people to take on behaviors that are in their best interest. Flow would probably be one of those books too. Talks about this idea of how we could get into a state where we are challenged, yet we feel like we're competent. So I would probably include Flow. And yeah, maybe Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, Daniel Kahneman, which probably could advisors should know that book. Yeah, everyone. That's on everybody's list. But somebody might say, I can't believe he's in that area. He didn't include that list. So let's include the Kahneman.
I love all those. That is awesome. You gave us many to go and read through. Then the last question I always like to ask is, you know, looking back at our conversation here, and I got this from Barron's that they do for all their panelists, is what's one piece of actionable advice you think that our listeners should take away from our conversation today?
Outside of the fact that I'm leaving this hotel at 4 o'clock, I guess that could be very actionable for your listeners to know. That's really, really important. I think with all of this, it is, whether it's through, we didn't get into assessment today. We didn't talk about client assessment beyond risk tolerance. We didn't talk about that, but I would say at a 30,000 foot level, it's for an advisor to be most effective relative to the space that we're talking about, our little corner that Brad and I are working in. It's no different than the work of a personal trainer. You need to find out where they are. The personal trainer might think that their client needs to lift 50 pounds. Well, you need to find out if they can lift 10 first. Where are they? And meeting the client where they are, as everybody that's listening to this knows, is understanding their hopes, their dreams, their fears, but also understanding their biases, understanding their money beliefs, understanding all these elements of their financial psychology, so that when you walk out of that meeting, that's just a commencement to a relationship that's going to require nudges, it's going to require communication, counseling, building of self-efficacy, dealing with client crises and whatnot. But meeting the client where they are and making sure you know where they are is certainly critical. So I'll put that as number one.
Well, because we didn't talk about risk assessments this time, maybe that means that we just have to have you back on again and we'll talk about all the risk assessments and planning, et cetera, going through to it. But Charles,
we'll do that. For people that have, your listeners that have insomnia, me talking about risk tolerance will be perfect for them.
we can have that part of our mindfulness or our relaxation series that we want to do of helping people.
There we go.
Charles Chafin, you are the man. Thank you so much for sharing your insight. And I know that there's listeners on here that I don't know why they wouldn't be following you already, but they probably want to continue to follow you more and learn more about everything you're doing. What's the best way for people to follow you, stay in touch with you, get in touch with you, all of the above?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's two spots. There's charleschafin.com, and then obviously the stuff Brad and I are doing is psychologyoffinancialplanning.com. So both of those sites are great. Love to hear from folks.
Awesome. Charles, thank you so much again for joining us here on Bridging the Gap. You stay well, all right?
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Bridging the Gap. Don't forget to give us a rating and let us know what you think.